instantly popped open. The companion stepped inside a dark hallway lined with doors and lifted the lantern. From the darkness beyond, they could hear children's voices, and among them a familiar voice calling out, "Ollie, Ollie, Oxenfree!" It was Jack. When he heard the voices of his friends, Jack called out with joy, and it was only a few twists and turns down the corridors to the cell where he was being held. There were happy hugs and handshakes all around, and the light of the lantern showed that not only was he unharmed for his experience, but the second shadow was intact as well. Hurriedly, Jack told them what he had learned from Abby Tornado and the others.
"Well," said Avon, "now we know what happened to the ships in the archipelago."
"We aren't going to leave the children here, are we?" said Jack.
"Of course we aren't," John said firmly. "They'll all be coming with us. All of them."
"No!"
Asterius protested, wringing his hands.
"There's been no paperwork to allow it. It simply can't be permitted."
The companion's only answer came from Avon, who drew her long knife and pointed it at the small creature. Asterius sighed.
"You see," he said to Charles, "no respect."
In moments, the rest of the cell doors had been opened, and the corridors, that had been black and silent, were ablaze with torchlight and the joyful laughter of children. Part 6. The Ninth Circle. Chapter 21. Shadows and Light. The old man had become fevered, and with the fever came delirium. So he began to speak, to tell stories, for it seemed as if no help would be coming after all, and all that remained for him was to tell stories and, finally, to die.
"This is a story," he began, his voice weak but clear, "about the secret of perpetual youth, not eternal life, for there is an ending to all things, but to live one span with the energy and vigour for life that one has as a child is a treasure worth seeking. And seek it I did. But when I found it, I realized it was not so much a secret as a terrible, terrible truth. And truths, once learned, can seldom be unlearned. The secret is a great lie. For there is no such thing as perpetual youth. It is only an illusion. Illusions can be kept. Illusions can be cherished. But they can never become real. And to choose to see oneself as a child forever is only that. Illusion. All things grow. All things change. And eventually, all things must pass. It is the way of life. To stay young is to remove oneself from the motion of the world. But to grow up is to take hold of that motion and use it, and shape the world for those who come after. It is not a choice. It is a responsibility."
"You're ill, Peter," said the woman in the mirror. "And that's merely a collection of useless platitudes, not a story. You should be quiet and rest."
"A story?" the old man said. "I know a story. Once there were two children, a brother and sister, named Phrixus and Helle, whose stepmother was a witch. She was a great beauty and had seduced their father into marriage. She hated her husband's children, and often wished there were some way to rid herself of them. And so, on the anniversary of her marriage, she had an idea. She constructed a house deep in an ancient forest. Its walls were made of sugared bread, and sweet wine flowed across its floors. Its roof was made of almond cakes. The windows were framed in boiled licorice root, and inside, cooking over the fire,
was a cauldron of a confection she called Turkish Delight, which smelled of winter, spring, and summer all at once. Children were drawn to the house, as all children would be, and one day so were Phrixus and Helle. But they saw her for what she was, and saw what she was trying to do to them, and they forced her into the oven she intended for them, and burned her to a crisp. Then they escaped by flying away on the back of a magical golden ram, and they lived happily ever after.
"You have it all wrong," the woman in the mirror said. "They escaped on the ram long before I ever built the cottage on Centrum Terrae, and it wasn't for them that I built it. It was for my own children, and I never meant to harm them."
The old man chuckled, then coughed.
"I'm getting my stories confused again, aren't I? I was confusing that tale with the story of Medea."
The woman in the mirror seemed to withdraw, then the image clarified again.
"They're the same story," she said, her voice subdued. "You just have the details wrong, Peter."
"How could I have forgotten how Jason betrayed Medea?" the old man said. "Or how she followed him to the ends of the earth and beyond, and then farther still? And finally she took upon him the revenge she had so long sought."
"She paid the price for her choices," the woman said. "A far greater price than she ever expected, and so did her husband. He is but a shade, and she a reflection. So why, after all this time, can they not be forgiven?"
"Because," replied the old man, "it is her sons who paid an even greater price than that. A price they continue to pay. A price they will always be compelled to pay, until the day they forgive themselves."
"But they did nothing wrong," the woman in the mirror exclaimed. "Nothing!"
"And never telling them that, Medea, is the sin you cannot repent of."
It was difficult to count the number of children the companions freed from Mysterious's labyrinth, because they wouldn't stand still long enough to be counted. At Charles's best estimate, there were between 100 and 200. The majority of them were lost boys, and so there were many happy embraces and reunions with Laura Glue and Avon. The rest of the children, perhaps 30 of them, were from various islands in the archipelago of dreams. Bert, John, and Charles decided that while Asterius was harmless enough, there was still a very real possibility that the stories of Circe were also true, and none of them wanted to meet the Enchantress, especially with hundreds of children in tow.
"She also tended to turn her visitors into swine," added Charles, "so I'm for leaving here, post-haste."
"Agreed," said John. He gestured out over the water. "It's low tide still, and the next islands are close in the same district as this one, so I think we can actually walk across." Charles clapped his hands.
"That's right. These are the Wandering Isles, where they greet travellers like royalty. What are we waiting for? Let's go."
Charles and the two-shadowed Jack took off at a trot across the shallow water, splashing other children along the way. Soon all the children were running and splashing their way across the narrows to the 8th group of islands.
"I think if we had any illusions about this being a stealth operation," Jack said to Bert, "they've pretty much been shattered now."
The Wandering Isles were very similar to Aiea, and the heritage of the inhabitants was obvious from the architecture of the Grecian houses and temples that dotted the nearby hills. The shore was open and well cultivated, and there was evidence of fishermen having been there recently. A large number of chickens bustled about pecking at insects and scorpions.
"That's a sign of civilization," said Charles. "A society with well-contented chickens is a well-contented society."
"You're a very odd man," said Bert.
"I get that more often than you'd think," replied Charles.
"What next?" Avon said to John. "Does the history say where else we need to go, or what we need to do?"
John shook his head and showed her the book. The pages after the ones about Aiea have been ripped out. We're on our own, I'm afraid. A peal of thunder rumbled through the air, and several of the children squealed in response. For the first time since the companions had come to the underneath, storm clouds began to gather overhead. Black, foreboding, they were an ill omen, and Bert pulled his collar tighter and shuddered as he watched the clouds rolling in.
"This is no ordinary storm," he said to Jack. "Avon and I have witnessed its like before. This is a time storm."
He pointed skyward, just to the east.
"Up above us is the Keep of Time, and as it crumbles, more and more portals into the past are being loosed," he explained. "They are colliding here, intersecting with no boundaries and no control. And I believe the center of every crisis we have encountered is here, in this very spot."
As Bert spoke, the air above them began to shimmer as if they were viewing a mirage. Suddenly, an airplane burst into view, engines screaming. It was a large, silver, twin-prop plane of a make that John didn't recognize. It roared past, just skimming over the surface of the water, and close enough they could see the face of the woman piloting it, and that of her navigator sitting behind her. A stenciled name on the fuselage identified the plane as a Lockheed Electra, but that was all they managed to make out before the pilot pulled up, gained altitude, and vanished to the east over the towers of Aiea.
"That's not good, if that was who it appeared to be," Bert said darkly. "Although it's nice to know she wasn't actually lost in the Pacific."
"Who was that?" asked John.
"It doesn't matter," said Bert. "What does matter is that the plane came from somewhere in the future, around 1937 or so. Time is starting to fracture."
"Look," Charles said, pointing to the east. "Here comes another one."
They looked, but it wasn't another plane that was dropping rapidly out of the sky toward the beach. It was the Indigo Dragon. The decks were manned by the Croatoans, and an all-too-familiar man was at the wheel.
"Greetings," Burton called out with a wave. "We meet again, caretakers."
Before the companions could respond, the Croatoan warriors, all heavily armed with knives and spears, had leapt over the sides of the airship and encircled them on the sand. Once more, they were captives.
"You planned to use the airship all along, didn't you?" John said.
"Of course," said Burton. "The chance to gain both an airship that could finally take me out of the underneath, as well as a dragon ship that could cross the frontier back into the real world, was too good to pass up. Besides, your crew had done most of the repairs anyway."
"You mean before you ate them?"
Charles spat.
"But how did you find us?"
In answer, Burton merely smiled and held up Laura Glue's compass rose. Bert groaned. It had still been attuned to seeking the caretakers. All Burton had to do was follow the glow. Avon pieced together something else.
"We didn't really escape from you, did we?" she said coldly. "You allowed us to escape, just so you could follow us."
Burton nodded and grinned more broadly.
"That I did," he replied. "And you are far too trusting, you helpless wench. Just because Billy could show you a shiny trinket, you thought you could trust him. And you were wrong."
From the foredeck of the Indigo Dragon, Hairy Billy smiled. But it wasn't the smile he'd shown them before, the smile of a friend and collaborator. This smile was cold and cruel. He took off the silver thimble he wore around his neck and dropped it to the deck as if it were trash. In that moment, the companions realized the full extent of how they had been manipulated and betrayed.
"But why, Burton?" said Bert. "What purpose did it serve?"
"You wouldn't willingly tell me where you'd taken our children," replied Burton. "So we had to let you think you'd escaped, so we could follow you. And from the looks of things," he added, looking around at the children playing in the sand and surf, "it was the right decision." "Now," he said, as he stepped closer and a more threatening tone crept into his voice, "where are our children?
And where is my daughter, Lilith?
None of them knew how to answer, or to even say anything that Burton might believe. At least, John thought to himself, none of the children had yet realized what was taking place there on the beach. None, save for one. Jack. Burton didn't know one of the children was actually a caretaker. Quietly, Jack was moving among the children, whispering to them, and several had already begun running toward the Indigo Dragon. Burton realized that they were about to be overwhelmed with children, and he barked a series of harsh commands to the Indians who were still aboard. The rest of the Croatoans climbed out of the ship and began to herd the children toward the nearby fishing cottages, which was exactly what Jack had intended to happen. He was hiding under one of the small fishing boats, and his expression told John that he needed to keep Burton's attention, even if only for a few more moments. "I'll tell you where your children are," John said, much to the other's surprise, "if you'll answer a single question for me."
"Fair enough, caretaker,"
agreed Burton, still fingering the spear that he had loosely cradled in his arms.
"What is your question?"
Why are the Pan and the previous caretaker enemies? Charles's jaw dropped, and he stared at John in amazement. That was not what he had expected him to ask of an avowed enemy of Peter Pan's. The reaction of the Croatoans was different. They looked at one another and nodded, as if this were one of the common stories of their people. Even the expression of the one called Murthwaite seemed to shift to one that was more respectful as Burton began to answer.
"Well asked, caretaker," the explorer said, a soft burr in his voice. "The Pan and his friend, now enemy, were as brothers once. They met here in the archipelago, and it was here that the Pan showed his friend the secret of how never to grow old. Then," he continued, "they met a maiden, and she gave them each a kiss. The Pan rejected his, for he thought that keeping it would make him grow old, and he feared this most of all. But the caretaker kept his kiss and fell in love with the maiden, and together they began to grow up. However, the caretaker had fears of his own, as well as reasons that compelled him to return to his world, and so he gave her a choice. He would leave the archipelago and abandon his duties, and her as well. Or she could come be with him, grow old with him, raise a family with him, but at the price of never returning to the archipelago."
Avon was silent, but the tears streaming down her cheeks told her friends that what Burton said was true.
"I never knew,"
Bert whispered.
"I never realized that was the choice she had."
"Ah, Avon,"
Charles said, his voice low.
"The old caretaker, your predecessor, and the Pan have been enemies ever since," said Burton. "Now I'm losing my patience. Where are our children?"
John's mind raced for some kind of an answer, whatever he could say that wouldn't make the situation worse. But suddenly, Burton was distracted by something more pressing. The other Croatoan's shouts caused him to turn and gasp in surprise as he watched the Indigo Dragon lift away from the beach and rise swiftly into the air. At the wheel, a smiling Jack waved, and in moments the airship was out of reach of the Croatoan's spears and arrows. Without a backward glance, Jack piloted the ship over their heads, pointed it westward, and vanished. Burton howled in fury and turned to John.
"You'll pay for this, caretaker. I promise you that."
He pulled his knife and was about to strike at John when suddenly the sky turned black and the island vibrated with thunder. Over the water, the air had begun to shimmer again. Something else was coming through one of the rifts in time. It was not an airplane this time. It was a ship, large, of a familiar design. It was a graceful, majestic vessel, and it slid smoothly through the air and water until it solidified in the shallows just footsteps from the Croatoans and the companions. Avon let out a shout, and Bert's mouth dropped open even as his eyes welled up with tears. It was the Argo. The long-missing red dragon had appeared at last. Burton's eyes blazed with recognition. To him, the appearance of another dragon ship, here, now, only confirmed his suspicions, which meant the two men at the helm, as young as they appeared to be, were his enemies. The men had an appearance of brothers, and were dressed in a similar manner to the Lost Boys. They were speaking in loud voices, tinged with Greek accents. They were Hugh the Iron and William the Pig, Jason's sons, the original Lost Boys. John's eyes widened in realization, and he looked at Bert, who nodded frantically. He realized the same thing John had about the two young men who were waving a greeting and coming ashore, not realizing that the Croatoans were preparing to attack. "Go back!" John yelled. "William! Hugh! Get back on the ship! You must get away!"
"What?"
one of the young men called, waggling a finger in his ear.
"I can't hear a thing with this cursed beeswax Peter put in our ears. Can you, Will?"
The other shrugged and tapped the side of his head, then, with the other hand outstretched in friendship, walked toward Hairy Billy. Instead of taking the proffered hand, the Indian lifted his spear and impaled the boy on it.
"No!"
Avon and John screamed together. Hairy Billy merely smiled wickedly and drove the spear deeper into the bewildered boy. The boy called William cried out in horror and leapt to his brother's defense, but the other Indians were already moving to the attack. This new spectacle was distracting enough to the Croatoans that Avon caught one of them off guard, throwing him to the ground and snatching away his spear. Quickly, she stabbed the Indians holding Charles and Bert, while John cold-cocked the one who'd been behind him and caught Avon's knife. The Croatoans were now being pulled in two fronts, but they were still focused on the weaker opponents with the dragon ship. Burton turned to face the companions and was knocked brutally off his feet by Avon.
"Being called a wench I can live with," she said, "but no one calls me helpless."
In a flash, Burton was back up and sparring with her, while Charles and Bert were busy with their own opponents. Only John tried to reach the two young men who had arrived in the Red Dragon, but he was not fast enough. The Croatoans fell on them, swords ripping and tearing at their flesh with the spears and knives. William made a valiant effort to defend himself, and was obviously skilled with weaponry, but he could do little more than fend off the attackers until he and Hugh could stagger back onto the ship. In seconds, the living dragon ship had pulled away from the shore and was gaining speed back toward the rift in time.
"No!" John shouted. "Don't let them go! Charles, we have to stop that ship!"
But it was already too late. The red dragon, the Argo, was already far away from the shore, carrying the battered bodies of William and Hugh with it. The air around the islands began to tremble, and again the sound of thunder split the air. And suddenly, the ship was gone. It had vanished back into time. John dropped to his knees and pounded the sand with his fists.
"We could have stopped it," he exclaimed. "We could have stopped it all, but now it's too late."
Even the Croatoans had paused in their attacks on the companions, realizing that something was amiss.
"What are you talking about?"
said Charles, still brandishing a spear at one of the Indians.
"What's wrong?"
"Don't you see?" John said. "William and Hugh were unharmed before Burton fought with them. He's the one who set this in motion. And now they've disappeared back into the ripples of time itself, where they are wrecking on the shoreline where Bacon found them 700 years ago. John stood and marched to Burton, grabbing him roughly by his jacket.
"If only you had listened," John shouted. "If only you had trusted us, this would all be over. And now it's all gone wrong. You fool. You arrogant fool."
"Look,"
Bert shouted, pointing over the water.
"It's coming back."
The thunder was constant now as time shuddered, and once more the red dragon sailed into view. But this time, it wasn't alone. Behind it, with the sole exception of the Indigo Dragon, all the other dragon ships, white, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet, were falling into a well-ordered formation. On the foredeck of the Red Dragon stood the two young men they had seen on the beach just minutes before, but they had changed. These were not boys, but men, who were battle-hardened and cold. And they were not entirely human, not any longer. The exposed metal on their arms, torsos, and faces showed that their bodies were at least partially mechanical. And even at that distance, the companions could hear the ticking emanating from their chests. These were the clockworks Laura Glue had warned them about, the abductors of the Lost Boys. And behind them, filling the decks of the seven dragon ships, were hundreds and hundreds of children. Some were dressed in animal skins, some in armor, but all of them were fitted for battle. The companions and the Croatoans stood mute as the armada came to rest in the shallows of the island. Then the leader of the army climbed over the Red Dragon's railing and jumped to the sand. He was a dark-skinned, blue-eyed young man, and on his head and shoulders was his mantle of command, the unmistakable head, horns, and pelt that comprised the Golden Fleece.
"Dear God," Avon whispered, her eyes locked on the golden warrior at the forefront of the army, now leaving the ships. "That's Stephen. That's my son."
Chapter 22. The Thimble. With only a gesture from their leader, the children's army streamed over the sides of the ships and through the water. In minutes, all of the adults, caretakers and Croatoans alike, were surrounded. A group of the children went to the nearby fishing cottages and captured the Indians there as well, and also the children who had been freed from the labyrinth, and who seemed more confused than anything else. It was only then that the thunder subsided enough for them to hear the soft melodies being played by the pipes. A tall, emaciated figure, cloaked and hooded in black, stepped off the Red Dragon. In his hands were the panpipes, and he played a tune that resonated strongly within everyone who heard it. But with the children, the effect ran more deeply. Every one of the children who had been on the ships wore glazed, entranced expressions. The piper was controlling them all.
"The King of Crickets," breathed Bert.
The music stopped.
"The very same,"
purred a voice that trembled with hate.
"But you may call me the Piper."
Avon was still too fixed on her son to notice or care what the tall man was saying. Stephen would hardly look at her. To him, she was simply one of his prisoners.
"He's only a child. He's not yet 9 years old," said Avon. "How can he be this...
John suddenly realized what had rattled her so. This Stephen, who commanded an army and wore the Golden Fleece, was a teenager, 14 perhaps older, and already had the manner and bearing of a man. Whatever else he had become, he was no longer a child.
"He was a child when I claimed him," said the piper. "He and the many, many others who serve me. They have travelled many places, and the journeys have taken several years to complete."
"But it's only been a few days," Avon cried.
"To you, perhaps," said the piper. "But our crusade has been in progress for a long while, and will go on longer still. We have returned here only to deal with a few loose ends."
There was a cry of pain and surprise, and the companions were astonished to see Burton lying on the ground, bleeding from his mouth and sobbing. Standing above him with a clenched fist was a girl who was dressed like the Croatoans. It was Burton's missing daughter, Lilith. He had seen her in the throng and rushed to embrace her, and was met with a blow to the face that belied her size. This wasn't a girl any longer, but a warrior, as her father had just discovered to his great sorrow.
"I almost feel sorry for the bugger," Charles whispered. He does all these awful things just to find his own child, and she's as entranced as the rest of them.
I'm not that sorry, Bert whispered back. Much of this is his fault.
What is it you want, Orpheus? John said, feigning boldness. Why are you doing all this?
Orpheus? The piper said in surprise. You think I'm Orpheus?
He tipped back his head and laughed, long and hard.
Oh, my dear caretakers, you have surprised me when I thought there were no surprises left in this world. It was worth returning just to hear that.
Not Orpheus, John whispered to Bert. How could we be so mistaken?
Bert shook his head.
I don't know. If the piper isn't Orpheus, then I'm at a loss.
How did he know?
Wondered Charles.
How did the piper know we were caretakers?
Before John could answer, several of the soldiers started to blink and shake their heads. Apparently, without constant reinforcement, the mesmerizing effects of the piper's music could not hold sway over them. The piper again raised the pipes to his lips and began to play, and instantly Stephen, Lilith, and all the rest of the soldier children straightened, their eyes glazing over once more. Then the tune took a wicked turn, and the Indian girl, Lilith, drew a long knife from her belt. She advanced toward the companions, and it became clear that the piper was compelling her to kill them. Avon rose to her feet and took a defensive stance. John may have been a soldier, but she was better at hand-to-hand combat. The girl was smaller, but the knife was lethally sharp, and it was obvious she could wield it with skill. All along the outskirts of the group, the children from the labyrinth huddled together in knots, terrified that something beyond their understanding was happening, and even more terrified that it was beyond the grown-ups' understanding, too.
"John, look!"
Charles hissed between clenched teeth.
"The piper is playing, but it isn't affecting Laura Glue or the children of Haven at all."
About 50 feet away, their little friend was putting on a brave face, but she was obviously scared to death and utterly unmoved by the piper's music. "She had beeswax in her ears," said John. "Didn't she?"
"It's not the beeswax,"
argued Charles.
"It's got to be something else that's shielding them from the spell."
Charles was right. The Indian girl Lilith was completely entranced and was circling Avon, fainting and lunging with the precision of a cold machine. But Laura was still crouching at the base of the rocks, a terrified expression on her face.
"None of the children from any of the dragon ships were able to resist the music," whispered Charles. "And Lilith succumbed again the minute he began to play. So what is it that makes the others immune?"
"I don't know," said John. "It must have something to do with Haven, maybe something peculiar to all the children who were there." John's breath suddenly caught in his throat when he realized the words he'd just spoken. Something unique, that only they possessed. Something peculiar to the children in Haven and the other children in the labyrinth who had been deemed unsuitable to enlist in the crusade. Something that made them immune to the effects of the piper's music. And suddenly John's heart began to race, and he realized what it was, what it had to be. But how could he use the knowledge to their advantage without getting everyone killed? His train of thought was broken by a scream. Lilith had at last found an opening in Avon's defenses and struck a wicked blow to her side. Avon dropped to her knees in pain, her left arm falling useless as her tunic turned crimson with blood. Lilith quickly moved forward for a killing strike, but was halted by a trilling harmony from the piper.
"No," he said. "Not yet, anyway. Defeating her is enough. There is no one who might stop us now."
Avon struggled to her feet as Lilith moved to take her place at the piper's side.
"No,"
Avon said, her voice a rasp of agony. "It's not over."
"Oh, but I think it is," said the piper.
He again put the pipes to his lips and played a discordant tune, and suddenly Stephen strode forward and, with a kick, forced his mother roughly to the ground.
He placed a sandaled foot on the back of her neck and pushed her face into the abrasive sand. All the while, his face was empty. Only the music and the illusion it painted in his mind mattered. The notes changed, and Stephen lifted his foot and turned to face the dragon ships.
"Shall I tell you about your son?"
the piper said, his voice cruel and mocking.
"Shall I tell you of all the atrocities he will commit and the death he will bring to the world? Do you want to know all the evil he has already done? Do you want to know the best part?"
the piper went on, his voice growing softer, but still dripping with wicked glee.
"He knows. Deep inside, somewhere within, he is still the child you remember. And as he goes forth at my command, at the head of my army, bringing destruction to the world beyond, he knows what he is being compelled to do, and there is nothing that can prevent it. He is mine, now and forever."
Avon did not move, but wept into the sand.
"My son is truly lost to me," she murmured dully. "Lost, my lost son."
Lost son, thought John. Lost boys. It had to be. Peter had known. He had been the piper once, so he had to have known, too, how to defeat the piper's spell. And Jamie had to have known as well, or else why send Laura Glue for him to begin with?
"Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," quoted the piper. "It was prophesied, inevitable. And now," he said, raising the pipes to his lips, "we shall have an ending and go forth to the great war that we have been building for 700 years.
"Stop!" John called out, in what he hoped was a forceful-sounding voice. "Show mercy. At least let her say her last farewell. Let her say goodbye to her child." Avon looked up at John. The fatigue and pain masking her face was not enough to hide her astonishment. What was he playing at? The piper tilted his head and smiled cruelly, as if sensing an opportunity for further torment.
"Farewell to her child," he purred. "Let it not be said I am without mercy, to a point."
He gestured with his hand, and Stephen spun about on his heel and stood above the battered figure of his mother once more. It was all John could do to keep his expression placid and his voice steady. "Avon," he said, "accept the piper's mercy. Say goodbye to your son. Say goodbye, and give him one final kiss." "Please," thought John, "please, Avon, see this. See this connection. For the sake of us all, see this in my eyes, and know what you must do." Avon saw it. She looked up at the piper, showing him a pleading, already grieving mother, needing, wanting this one small thing.
"May I?" she asked. "May I give my son a kiss?"
The piper preened at the plaintive, almost desperate tone in her voice.
"Yes," he whispered, "for this, the last time you shall ever see your son, I shall permit a kiss."
Avon tilted her head slightly in acknowledgement of the act of mercy. She stood shakily, weak from loss of blood, and slowly, painfully, walked to her son. Stephen looked indifferently at his mother, his arms crossed. His gaze was not dead, but it was passionless. There was no spark, only drive. He was a tethered life that lacked his soul, and it showed in the vacancy of his eyes. And in moments, his master was going to use him to start a conflagration that would consume the world. Avon choked back a sob. She leaned in, as if to kiss Stephen's cheek, then, masking the motion with her crippled left arm, she swiftly reached up with her right hand and pulled something out of her tunic. She kissed him and at the same moment slipped the small silver thimble into his hand. For an instant, it seemed as if nothing happened. Then Stephen's eyes went wide, and he began to shudder. The piper's eyes narrowed. Something was amiss. Avon watched a myriad of emotions suddenly flowing across her son's face, and he made a small noise, as if in pain. And then his eyes cleared. They widened, focused, narrowed. And Avon's son smiled at her.
"Mother," he said softly, "you know I don't like being kissed in front of my people."
The piper snarled and lifted his pipes to his lips. Before she could react, Stephen thrust Avon behind him and in the same wheeling motion hurled his long knife at the piper. It struck him in the throat before a note could be sounded by the pipes, and he let out a choking scream. There was a thunderclap and a shattering across the sky, and the figure of the piper exploded into shards of darkness. Guided by the shadow that had sought him out and bound itself to him, Jack steered the Indigo Dragon past the last of the Wandering Isles into the sixth and final district of the Underneath, to the last island. The ninth circle, according to Dante, the center of hell. Not some place one might choose to go willingly, but Jack did. Not because he was compelled by the shadow, but because he felt its need. It needed help, and it had sought him out. Not one of the adults. Jack. Young Jack. It trusted him, and he could not betray that trust. Incredibly, the ninth island was small and unremarkable. All that it appeared to hold were a few stunted trees and a tumble of stones that appeared to be a cairn, or perhaps the entrance to a cave. Jack tilted the guidelines of the Indigo Dragon, spun the wheel, and headed for the island. The pieces of darkness that had formed the piper's body were thousands upon thousands of crickets, which scattered into the crevices and under the rocks, the better to escape the light. But what remained behind had nowhere to go. It was a shadow, and only a shadow. When its body was destroyed, the pipes fell to the ground and cracked apart. They would not be easily repaired, and the effect of their breaking was obvious and immediate. The children began to awaken. The long enchantment they had been under was over. As their eyes began to clear, they became themselves again. Those who were armed dropped their weapons. Those with friends recognized them and embraced them in a happy, bittersweet reunion, for to some of the children it had been only a few days since they'd parted. For the rest, it had been years. Even Burton was sobbing, as his daughter dropped to her knees and embraced him.
"Ah, oh, my Lilith, my Lily girl," he said. "I've missed you so."
"I missed you too, Papa," said the girl.
The shadow hissed and rose into the air.
"You may have destroyed my form,"
the former piper hissed, its words like acrid smoke.
"But I have not come here alone."
Hugh the Iron and William the Pig, the half-clockwork lost boys, were still under some kind of compulsion. The destruction of the panpipes seemed not to deter them at all. They marched briskly to the Red Dragon and removed from its deck several large paving stones, which they laid end to end in a path that led from the ship to the clearing where the shadow of the piper still hovered. Then one last passenger calmly climbed over the railing of the Red Dragon and, careful to step only on the stones, walked toward the astonished companions. It was Daedalus.
"You gave your word the children would not be harmed," the inventor said to the shadow.
"And none of them have been,"
the shadow hissed.
"Yet. You said you would deliver all the caretakers to me as children, yet when I arrived, I find them fully grown."
"They wouldn't look into the well," replied Daedalus. "Only the one, Jack, and I don't see him here."
"One is not three, Daedalus,"
the shadow said.
"Had they been children, I might have entranced them with their pipes,
and we would be done with this.
Laura Glue cried out in happiness and ran forward to embrace Daedalus, not realizing what was actually taking place. Charles reached out and caught her, then pulled her close.
"What is this?"
Avon exclaimed.
"What have you done, Daedalus? What have you allied yourself with?"
"He was against us all along," said John. "That's why he wanted us to look into Echo's Well, and that's why the history is missing the last pages. It was all a trap."
"Try not to think too badly of me, Avon," Daedalus said,
as Hugh and William continued to remove stones from the ship and lay them around the clearing.
"I simply did what I must, as we all do. You were motivated by love of your son, while I simply wanted to get out of that damned city of children. That accursed tower, where I've been trapped for all these centuries."
"So much for repentance and redemption, eh, Daedalus?" said John.
"Spare me your Christian balms," said Daedalus. "My nephew had humiliated me, and while it wasn't my intent to kill him, I couldn't let his offence simply pass."
"And what of Icarus?" put in Bert. "What of your own son?"
Daedalus started, then regained his composure.
"Regrettable. I never wanted it to happen. My designs were not perfected then, so it really wasn't my fault. It was an accident, that's all. An accident."
"You have to be the worst father I've ever heard of," said Charles.
"You're forgetting Jason," said Bert,
with a sorrowful look at Hugh and William.
"Peas in a pod," Charles stated. "Both despicable."
"Enough talk," spat the shadow. "Honor your bargain, Daedalus. Destroy them."
"I hate to deflate your balloon," said Charles, "but the panpipes are broken. You no longer control your army of children, and those two," he gestured at Hugh and William, "are no match for all of us."
"Fortunately for us," Daedalus replied, "Hugh and William are not the only servants at my command."
Daedalus raised a hand and made a complicated gesture with his fingers, and an instant later the companions heard a thunderous noise, followed by a tremor.
"Is that thunder?"
said Burton, looking up at the dark skies.
"It isn't thunder," declared Charles. "It's the sound of a master chessman making an excellent move."
The sounds were echoing across the islands, with a regular rhythm now, and far to the north, Talus and the other bronze clockwork giants moved into view. They would be upon them in minutes.
"Check," said Daedalus, "and mate."
The shadow laughed, and all John could think was that it sounded nothing at all like crickets. The entrance to the cave was guarded by a dozen children, all dressed in dirty animal skins. Of the beasts he could identify, there was a fat boy in a bearskin, three girls dressed as foxes, two smaller boys dressed as possums, and one boy who had unsuccessfully clothed himself as a skunk and who stood a distance away from the rest. As Jack approached, the children jumped to attention, raising crude, handmade stone and wooden weapons, but they relaxed immediately when they saw it was a child like themselves.
"Did you bring us anything to eat?" one of the foxes asked. "The King of Crickets keeps forgetting, and he hits us if we ask."
"I'm sorry, I didn't," said Jack.
"Tratton down," the girl said. "I'm tired of standing guard. I want to play a different game."
"You're playing a game?" Jack said.
"Yes," one of the other girls said, nodding. "Do you want to play? I'm Boo Radish. Who be you?"
I'm Jack," said Jack. "What kind of game?"
"There's a monster inside," said the skunk boy. "He looks like a normal long beard, but he's a monster just the same, and we have to keep him here in the cave."
"So you're the frogs, then?" asked Jack. The second fox clapped her hands.
"You do know the game. Why didn't you say you were a lost boy?"
The fat bear puffed out his chest.
"If we guard the monster, we get to be lost boys, too."
"I only just found out I was one," said Jack. "Can I go in?" The beast children moved aside deferentially, and Jack and his two shadows stepped to the mouth of the cave. Not far inside was a frame to which the monster the children guarded had been tied.
"I think I have something that belongs to you," said Jack.
"Thank you for bringing it back," answered Peter.
"Did Jamie send you, then?"
"In a manner of speaking," said Jack, "I'm one of his replacements. I came with Laura Glue."
"That's my girl," the old man said.
"So, caretaker, would you like to play a game?"
Chapter 23 Unraveled. The bronze giants were nearly upon them, and the children had begun to panic. The adults were doing their best to maintain order, but it was impossible. There were too many children, and there was no way to organize any kind of defense against so massive an enemy. All the while, Daedalus and the Piper's Shadow merely watched the chaos taking place around them. Only John kept his wits about him.
"There are no coincidences," he shouted to Bert over the din. "Even with the time storm, we had to have come here for a reason. There has to be a purpose to all of this."
"What are you thinking, John?" asked Bert.
"This! Look at this!" John said, pointing to the illustration of Artano in the Geographica.
In the very center was an image of a chariot drawn by two dragons.
"Medea's chariot," said Bert. "What of it?"
"Look at the names inscribed underneath."
Bert looked, and his eyes widened in shock and surprise. One of the dragons was Samarinth, and the other was a green-gold beast called Azer.
"And look at the shape," said John. "Look at the entirety of the underneath. What does it look like to you?"
"Rings within rings," Bert gasped,
as what John was driving at dawned on him.
"It's a giant ring of power."
"Will it work?"
"Where do you think the kings of the archipelago got their authority?" said Bert. "It had to begin somewhere. Why not here, where the original legends of heroes began? It's worth trying."
But it was nearly too late. With thundering footsteps, the bronze giants began encircling the shore, towering above the companions and the children. Quickly, John grabbed Avon and Stephen and explained what he wanted them to do. Then he showed the Prince of the Archipelago the summoning for the dragons and told him to read it aloud. The giant clockworks were nearly upon them, trapping them all. There was no escape, either to the hills or to the ships. Unless they did something then and there, there would be no battle.
"Read it,"
John instructed Stephen, thrusting the Imaginarium Geographica at him.
"Read it."
Stephen nodded and knelt, bending protectively over the book.
"By right and rule, for need of might, I call on thee, I call on thee. By blood bound, by honour given, I call on thee, I call on thee. For life and light your protection given, from within this ring by the power of heaven, I call on thee, I call on thee."
As he finished, the last of the giant bronze automatons moved into place. They were surrounded. The bronze giants were all that was necessary to turn the frightened children into obedient, subdued drones once more. Children know when the threat of violence is real and cannot be defied. And so, when William and Hugh began to herd them onto the ships, it was in silence and order. Daedalus had ordered the adults, both caretakers and Croatoans, to kneel in the sand.
"It was an excellent effort," Daedalus said, "but ultimately futile."
He turned to Avon.
"Don't worry. None of the children will be harmed. Whatever you may think of me, I'm not without feeling."
"What will you do with them?" asked Charles.
"Those who choose to return to our crusade will come on the ships," said the Piper's Shadow. "The rest will be returned to the Minotaur's care on Aiea."
"Imprisoned in the labyrinth, you mean?"
Charles said.
"It's better than death," said Daedalus, "as I'm afraid you're about to learn."
"What are you waiting for?"
Burton whispered to John.
"Don't bother denying it. You, the wench, and the old man are all watching the skies. What are you expecting to happen?
I don't know, John replied. A miracle, perhaps?
Well, I'm not going to simply die kneeling in the sand, said Burton, and neither will the Croatoans.
But, he hesitated,
if you do have some miracle planned, will you do what you can to save my daughter as well? Please?
John drew back and looked at the leader of the Indians. His face was open, sincere. He had made a request, but had also meant it as an apology. Of course, John finally said, if it is in my power to do so, I'll save your girl.
Thank you, said Burton.
What in Hades is that?
The piper's shadow exclaimed. John and the others looked to the sky. The dark clouds continued to roll and churn, but there, to the west, something else was approaching.
The dragons? Exclaimed Bert. Is it, John? Did the summoning work after all?
But it wasn't the dragons moving beyond the clouds. It was something much, much bigger. Jack had found Peter Pan, the man who had summoned them to the archipelago, and he carried with him Peter's shadow, which had guided him to the last island in the underneath, and all of this had been done under terrible circumstances and against impossible odds. But there was one more obstacle Jack could not seem to overcome. He could not enter the cave. A peal of laughter sounded from somewhere behind Peter, and Jack could just make out the image of a beautiful woman in an ornate mirror that hung on the cave wall.
"He doesn't know, Peter," she said. "He doesn't realize what he has to give up to come in."
"He is a caretaker of the Imaginarium Geographica," said Peter. "I'm sure he understands sacrifice."
"Sacrifice?" Jack said, taking a step back. "What do I have to sacrifice? Why can't I enter the cave?"
"This is the center of the underneath," said Peter. "One of the oldest islands that exist. And nothing can come into the cave that isn't real."
"I don't understand," said Jack. "What isn't real?"
"Tell me," said Peter. "Who are you? Who are you really, Jack?"
"How did you know my name?"
"We've met before," Peter told him, "which is how I know this isn't really you. Now tell me," he said again, "who are you?"
I'm just Jack."
"No," said Peter, "you aren't. You can't be if we're to save your friends."
"I know what you're asking of me," Jack said dully. "It's just difficult to give it up."
"I know," said Peter, "perhaps better than anyone. But you can't stay a child forever. To choose to speak into echoes well is to choose illusion. To choose to avoid the responsibilities of being an adult. The real trick, the real choice, is to keep the best of the child you were, without forgetting when you grow up. It is the best of both worlds, Jack. Being a child is to believe in magic everywhere. But even Peter Pan had to grow up one day."
It may have taken minutes or hours for the massive apparitions to come clearly into view in the diffused light of the underneath, and the clouds of the time storm were still floating thickly in the air. But when the clouds finally began to dissipate, and the companions could see clearly once more, they saw giants. The great creatures were almost incomprehensible. They were chessmen that aspired to be continents, and they moved with the tectonic grace that their smaller mechanical counterparts lacked. There was no booming tremor with the footsteps of the giants, which towered over the clockworks as if the automatons were toys, just motion and coiled energy.
"Is that what we summoned?" asked John.
"Stephen called giants to us instead of dragons?" Bert spoke in a hush, awed by the sight.
"The giants were the architects of the Rings of Power. I didn't know they still existed,
much less that they could be summoned.
The giants were almost shapeless, having only a vaguely human form. They had no